This means that Donald Trump will be the 45th president of the United States.
This is your life now. This is our election now. This is us. This is our country. It's real.
Hi, and welcome back to the 45th. Hey, Susan.
Hey, Rabia.
It's been a couple of weeks.
It's been a couple of weeks or lifetimes. Yeah. One or the other.
I want to get right to why it's been a couple of weeks so we can give our listeners a heads up, and then we'll move into, oh my God, an avalanche of news. Well, it's been a tough year. It's been tough really across the podcasting industry for the last few months because of the virus and sponsors and stuff, and obviously all our production, it can only happen if we have sponsors helping to pay for it. So because of that, we're going to have to cut back to about every other week. For now, right?
Yes, we are not going to, stop till Trump is wherever he goes next. But for the current future, until the ad situation settles down, we're probably going to be seeing you every other week. But of course, if something truly groundbreaking happens, you might hear from us sooner than that.
Like Trump resigns. We'll do that.
If Trump resigns, I'm calling you right then and there. We're recording an episode like from our phones that moment.
I don't care if I'm in the toilet. You do it. You call me. And we're going to produce it no matter what. Yeah. So, you know, it kind of sucks. So I do feel like there's always a lot of news every single week to cover. I mean, every single day even. But it is what it is. This is the times we're living in. Coronavirus times, folks. But you can always follow us online because we are always tweeting the news there. All right. So let's get right to it. We always start with coronavirus updates. This is the first week I have not looked at the Johns Hopkins numbers, but I do know, I have read just yesterday in the Washington Post, we are on track to be hitting about 100,000 new positive cases a day. Yes, a lot of that is related to the fact that we have a lot more testing happening, but also we've got about a dozen states now rolling back their reopening plans, including, I think, Texas and a number of others where there's been huge booms, Arizona. I don't know what they're doing in Florida, because just yesterday I saw the Florida lieutenant governor attack Dr. Fauci on Fox News.
This was Texas.
Was it the Texas lieutenant governor? It could be both. But, you know, DeSantis is just like, I mean, he's still in his, oh, this has to do with, like, Latino workers, and agricultural workers and protests, not about reopening and not being careful. But, yeah, so we are experiencing all kinds of horrific booms. You have situations like, for example, I think one of the states the other day just issued the orders that allow doctors to make decisions about who is worthy and not worthy to get care because they are so stretched thin on beds and hospitals. And so we're not just talking about positive cases. We're talking about increased hospitalizations and deaths too. But what we are seeing now in the last couple of days, I think, is kind of a much more concerted attack on Dr. Fauci. Have you noticed? I don't know if you, I know you've been really busy.
So this will be the first week where, Rabia, you'll be telling me the news as well as our listeners.
Okay. I'll tell you what I have caught here and there. Laura Ingraham yesterday on her news show, just out and out, attacked Dr. Fauci, said that he is maybe working for Biden. And this is because this man basically keeps, you know, sounding the alarm bells, really in the least political way possible. There was a hearing a couple of days ago, or I believe a briefing, excuse me, not a hearing. And Paul Rand, Dr. Fauci, again, is explaining that, look, we need to continue to social distance, wear masks, wear masks, wear masks.
And you call him Paul Rand.
Is that his name? Rand Paul? Randy Paul.
Paul Ryan, Rand Paul. It's hard to keep him straight.
Yeah, Ron Johnson, whatever. Yeah, so he went after him. He's like, can't you give us any good news? It's day after day. Now you're going to tell us we can't play baseball? I mean, the response has been ridiculous. Of course, Trump's response and the administration's response is no better.
I don't want to generalize too much, but I feel like this is sort of maybe it was always like this, but the Trump era is definitely marked by Trump's commitment to bullshit. In the sense of, like, he doesn't care about whether what he's saying is true or false. He just cares about making noise and putting positions out there. And the idea that reality still matters seems to have, like, faded from public consciousness. And so now that this very real thing is very really happening, it seems like Fox News and a big chunk of the Republican establishment cannot comprehend the idea that sometimes reality is reality. And no matter what you say about it, it ain't going to change.
Well, it's not going to change, but then it's like, but at the same time, they're not going to change either. I mean, like, so just on Sunday, Pence went to a church, like, campaign event, basically, with, like, I don't know, 2,000 plus people in attendance. He was masked, but nobody else was. And there was a choir. And we know, by the way, I mean, like, there have been, like, even experiments showing, like, how much we, you know, aspirate droplets out of our mouths when we're like singing or yelling or talking. This huge choir, like a couple hundred people, are just singing at full steam for a couple of hours in this thing. That happened. You know, Trump was recently at a, I think in Texas, in this mega church with like this like youth, like just like a bunch of young Nazis to me, rally. And so they continue to do this, and Trump continues, he is going to continue to have his rallies. He said he has. Of course, he had a kind of a bit of a disastrous one last week. Did you catch that, by the way? I think that happened after.
Yeah. So I was moving past, like, whatever this whole thing went on. It was a very long week. But I did catch the rally, and I caught the – I just love how in the buildup they were talking about how they'd had the two different, I guess, speeches or rallies, one for the indoor audience, one for the outdoor audience.
So a million people coming.
So,
yeah,
the overflow audience would be so huge. And then they didn't even fill the stadium at all. It was like half filled.
Yeah.
Of course it is. Which
less than half.
Which is encouraging because it means that even Trump supporters, there's only a small fraction of them that was willing to sacrifice their own health to go see him. Like, right. It's not, I don't think it's a sign necessarily. I don't think that's a sign that he's lost support from his base, although I think there's other signs that he has. But even among the hardcore Trumpies, like that, they're like, okay, well, you know, I'm going to pass on this one because there's a pandemic.
Right. I got to read this quote, by the way, from a story, I think just today, or no, yesterday, excuse me, from the Washington Post, because I just, oh my God. Here's a quote. Alex Castellanos, a veteran Republican strategist, said the divide over whether to cover one's face is like many things in the Trump era political. Quote, mask wearing has become a totem, a secular religious symbol. Christians wear crosses, Muslims wear a hijab, and members of the Church of Secular Science bow to the gods of data by wearing a mask as their symbol, demonstrating that they are either the elite, smarter, more rational, and morally superior to everyone else. I can't disagree with that last part of it, but yeah. There is still, even though you're right, that there are, while it's a good sign that supporters didn't show up in the same kind of throngs that Trump was expecting for the rally, at the same time, there is like this, it's the mask itself has become a political symbol because Trump refuses to wear it. At the same time, Pence is like, yeah, you should wear it, but pray.
But I mean, look at Arizona today. As of right now, they're setting new records every single day. They are now at a 24% positive rate for COVID testing. That is scary because we have more testing now, and they're starting to hit like New York numbers from back at the start of this. That means things are very, very bad there. And yet, we now know that there are some really good ways of fighting the spread of this while still maintaining some degree of public life. Namely, wearing masks and not gathering indoors.
Yeah, it's like literally those two very, very simple mitigating things. I mean, like that's it. It can cut the rate to the transmission rate so low. And you can continue to have a public life. Although, I mean, there's not a day goes by.
It's a limited life, but it's not stuck in your house 24/7. You could still reopen certain aspects of normal life enough to get by for a year.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, the thing is, like, the longer we don't do it, the longer we're stuck in this hell is the thing. This is what they don't seem to get. The fix is to just suck it up for, like, 2 to 3 months, and that's it. And we're free. I mean, other countries have shown us this is possible. We have some states that have shown us this is possible. So, anyway.
The focus right now needs to be on getting schools open. Like, in terms of, if you think of the COVID spread.
That's the real scary question, yeah.
But if you think of COVID spread as, like every time you have interactions, that's adding to the risk. We need to prioritize schools as like the only risk we're taking because we just can't function like this. And the long-term consequences are going to be devastating, especially for working mothers. Like how many women can keep their job for a year if they're still watching their kids?
Very few.
Our pool of like human interactions, we need to prioritize the school puddle and we can fill up the rest later. And I'm how sorry, but that bars safely. Are not getting into sex.
Yeah. I mean, so far what I've seen, what I'm seeing with the schools that my kids attend and, you know, others in the area, the schools right now seem to be wanting to offer kind of a mixed thing, like some online learning, some staggered in-person learning. But I don't think they have it figured out yet. And I think parents also are not quite sure. I mean, because even between now and, let's say, September, when schools open, we don't know what the picture is going to look like, you know, like in terms of the virus in the country. And it's, I am so, so lucky that at this point in my career, I can have my daughter study from home. But most of my career, I would not have been able to do that. She would have had to go to school one way or the other. For a lot of kids, those are the only times they get meals. I mean, there's so many reasons, but yeah. And it's really bad for kids, especially younger kids, to just be home. Anyway, so, but it's not good news. But the thing is, other countries have done it. I saw a video, I just don't know. I think this is a couple months ago, actually, that out of China, when they started reopening schools, I think in the Wuhan region, how many precautions, the camera followed this one student, you know, he's masked the whole time. That will be hard for kids, by the way, but he's masked the whole time. He gets to school. He's literally like sprayed with something, like his clothing and stuff. Everybody's masked. It's like they check the temperature. It's a step by step by step before he actually gets in.
So it'll take a lot of discipline. Class outside every day.
Oh, you know, look, my heart goes out to the teachers. No matter what, it's not going to be easy. All right, so let's get to the really big story, I think, that's been evolving over the last couple of days that broke over the weekend, and that is a Russian bounty story. I don't know if you've caught this, Susan, but this is one to definitely...
This is like the thing I learned, I think, last night when I sat down for the first time in ages, was open Twitter and saw something about Russian bounties. And I just, I'm like, what? Why are we... Well, no. The first thing I saw was the white power thing. I'm like,
The video.
Of course. And the next thing I learned about was the Russian bounties. And I'm like, Jesus Christ.
For those of you who don't know, there was a video circulating online of this retirement community down in Florida where I just thought I would watch this reality show, by the way. You had like this white power parade, basically, of like some of the residents. They're like in their golf carts with Trump banners and American flags. And one man distinctly yelling white power while anti-Trump, you know, protesters, also residents of the senior community, stood by and yelled at them, and they all just kind of cussed each other. It was fantastic. But Trump retweeted the video. I guess it's a show.
Take it down for 3 hours.
Because he was golfing, Susan.
That's what they say. So the article the first thing I saw was like, Trump didn't take down white power video because they couldn't reach him at golf course.
Right.
So I'm like trying to process this. I'm like, wait, okay, one, created white power. Okay. But you know, I get that. It was at a retirement community in Florida, I guess. Okay. You know what? Let's okay. And then it didn't come down for 3 hours while he was golfing because they couldn't reach him. Now, as bad as the white power video was, if they truly couldn't reach the president for 3 hours, that would be the far bigger crisis. Yeah. That would be insane. I mean, our country would stop functioning on a basic level. The president cannot be unavailable ever. Not when he's needed. Not for something like this.
I mean...
Which means they're lying. They're clearly lying.
They're lying, right. The That's not even possible.
They couldn't reach Trump. The problem was that Trump initially did not agree to take the video down. Mm-hmm. So it took him 3 hours to convince him that he needed to take down a video that he retweeted or tweeted. I haven't even seen the video actually yet.
Oh, God, watch it. It's wonderful. There's especially this lady named Sharon who's amazing. I love her. I want her to be my grandma.
It means that Trump, like, they had to coerce him or just incur, like, they had to talk the president into leading a video called someone saying white power of his supporter. Because to Trump, it doesn't matter what you say or what creed you're spouting out. If you're wearing a red MAGA hat, he's down with it.
Oh, yeah. He'll take support from anywhere. But also, I think he actually believes in it. So there's that, too.
True. But, like, I have no doubt that Trump would, like, in the same 5 minute span, would retweet, like, a KKK guy, like, in his sheet saying, like, go Trump. And then right away retweet, I don't know, some of his black supporters like doing anything at all.
Are you saying what Black Lives Matter really needs is like to go pro-Trump?
I'm saying if Black Lives Matter was pro-Trump, we would have like in caps all day tweeted out Black Lives Matter.
You're probably right. You know, they might want to think about that. All right. So
policies, he wouldn't do anything to advance the cause, but he would profess belief in it and just shout things out if BLM protesters wore MAGA hats.
I think if protesters were pulling down Confederate flags but putting up MAGA posters, he'd be fine with it. That's what you're saying, essentially.
He would be like, he would go out there and join them.
He'd be pulling down Andrew Jackson all by himself. All right. So the first story you saw was white power, and then you saw the Russian bounties, and that's where.
Which I still don't even know the full extent of it, because at that point my brain stopped working, and I'm like, I just know what.
And you didn't have the bandwidth for it.
I did see that not only was this like a, this is not a new story. In fact, in 2019, this was a known thing, and it still is only now coming out.
Right. So apparently, okay, according to lots of different reporting, but I read on the Military Times this morning that there were intelligence about this. So basically what it is this, and it started by apparently the intelligence came out of interrogations with detainees in Afghanistan. And I don't know if the interrogations were done by U.S. forces or by Afghani officials. However, there are detainees that said that there has been this whole scheme where Russia has been offering bounties for the heads of U.S. Soldiers and, you know, for killing soldiers, they'll pay Taliban and others, like, you know, money for however many American soldiers they kill. And at least, so there were some reports apparently back in 2019, Bolton also emerged the other day. And I don't know, it kind of, it was like a blip. It came on and then I couldn't, there was no, it didn't go anywhere really, but said that he himself had verbally told Trump about this in 2019. And told others that he told Trump, but he did not mention it in his book because it was classified and he couldn't mention it. Now, apparently, there are like 20 American service members that were killed in Afghanistan since the start of 2019. Yeah, and these reports of these bounties are actually connected to two very specific attacks on American soldiers, in which I think five or six soldiers were killed. Now, also there's reporting that... repeatedly, you know, President Trump gets these intelligence briefings that are, I mean, he gets like a report every day, like a written report that takes apparently less than an hour to read. Like they're about 20 pages, which he does not read. And then there's some verbal briefings. It was included in his written materials in February. In March, there was apparently an interagency meeting about this issue. Again, no response from the White House on it. And so, what's been going on is that the White House has, I mean, the responses have just been all over the place. The first response was he was never briefed. Nobody told him. Then it's like, okay, no, it was like actually in written materials. Bolton said, no, I told him verbally. Then it was like, well, he was told, but it was part of this ongoing top secret investigation. And the New York Times screwed it all by reporting on this. And so, you know, they've put American soldiers' lives in danger. Then it evolved to, it wasn't verified information. So the president actually never got it. That's what was said at a press briefing 2 days ago by Kaylee. She said it was never elevated to the president because the veracity wasn't confirmed of the reports. Now this week, the White House has provided briefings to both Republican and Democratic leaders. And there do seem to be, and even some Dems came out of the briefing saying that there do seem to be some conflicting reports on this. However, there's also reporting now that financials, one of the reasons analysts believe that this actually took place was because of these financial trails they've been trying to figure out what was happening. And so they believe that this is linked to this. And this is what the New York Times says. That Americans intercepted electronic data showing these huge financial transfers from a bank account controlled by Russia's military intelligence agency, the GRU. We've talked about plenty of times. And these transfers were made to a Taliban-linked account. And they were trying to figure out, like, what was going on. And apparently, Afghani officials arrested a bunch of businessmen in some kind of bust who were transferring money through there's like this informal exchange system called Hawala. And they ended up finding like $500,000. I mean, that's a lot of cash to have in Afghani money in one of their houses. They've been trying to figure out what it is. And now they've been told by some of their sources that this was part of the money that the GRU was sending to Afghanis to kill soldiers.
So here's what I have not seen yet, and I've been wondering about. What is the motivation of the Russians here? What was their particular strategy or goal of doing this?
That I don't know, other than they are not friendly to the United States. They
generally wanted to fuck with us. Like, is there like something bigger? Because the first thing I thought of was, I mean, the attempts from Trump to like negotiate with the Taliban. Remember the whole failed Taliban summit happened like September or August?
And that actually happened also apparently after he had been briefed about this. But yeah.
So is their goal to like somehow stop Trump from pulling out of Afghanistan? I don't understand.
I don't know. I'd be interested in hearing like what some analysts have to say about what they think strategically Russia might be trying to achieve here. I mean, look, you know, Russia has had their own really terrible history of Afghanistan. They were once invaders and occupiers. Maybe they're just longing for those days. I don't know what it is. It could just be, though, just continuing to destabilize the United States and hurt U.S. interests.
But this is, I mean, Trump, knowing this is like old news by this point, is been advocating for Russia to rejoin the G7 or G8. Like, that's insanity. Like, the idea, this is an actual enemy state that's actively killing American lives and targeting them. Aside from the general like geopolitics of it, this is like actually an act of war.
That's what I was thinking. I was like, isn't this an act of war? When you have a nation state paying to or you know, in one way or the other, having your soldiers killed, it seems like an act of war to me.
In every way, it is. And this is what I just keep thinking of Trump talking about, like how Obama was like taken advantage of, and that like how Putin only went for Crimea because Obama was so weak, and it was a sign of like how much disrespect Putin had for Obama. And then imagine that like that's what Trump's line is when he was having hit American soldiers targeted by Putin and he just ignored it. The hell?
I mean, you know, I really think that if Trump was, you know, he had information about, like, he was given this information. First of all, he openly says he doesn't trust our intelligence agencies. And if Putin told him it's not true, which is, by the way, the official Russian response is that this is complete bullshit. It's not true. He is going to believe Putin. He's going to, I mean, like, we've shown this over and over again, that he will say, this is what Putin says, and I believe Putin, over our entire intelligence community composed of, like, 16 agencies.
I guess, it's like, he can't acknowledge the truth of it if it's true. Like, he can't even, like, what's his motivation here? I guess he just can't say it's true. So if it's true, then he looks weak, so therefore it can't be true.
He looks weak, or there's something Putin's got. I mean, like, the question's always, that outstanding question has always existed. What does Putin have over this guy? That makes him so complacent towards him. I don't know.
Trump loves authoritarians. But does his love go that far?
Probably, yeah. Maybe. I mean, so far that he's willing for, like, that Americans will get killed. I mean, the thing is, Trump thinks it's all transactional for him. If Russia is helping Trump, Trump doesn't care about anybody else, including American lives.
He's helping America. How's Russia?
Helping Trump.
How, though?
I mean, they helped in the election. That was the whole thing, right? Like, that was all 2016. If Putin is like, we're going to make sure you get reelected, just shut the fuck up.
Like, this is not helping him get reelected.
It's only not helping because it's become public. If people didn't know this, if people didn't have any idea that Russia was doing this or that Trump knew it, then, you know, then yeah, he'd be fine. I mean, 20 U.S. soldiers, yeah, it's a lot of soldiers. But at the same time, you are like, I mean, it's not like 200 or 2000, right? It's enough that most of us completely miss it.
So I'm just not sure I can believe yet that Trump at this point would objectively think that Russia can provide more help to him to a point where it's worth tolerating the ways they're harming his election.
I think Trump has always, like from day one, Trump has been like, you know, Russia, look into Hillary's emails. I think he has more faith in Putin than he does in the elections here. Look, already speaking of which, he's been, you know, tweeting quite a bit about like election fraud, this and that. I think he's gearing up to Biden is pulling further and further ahead in the polls. And so I think he sees what's in front of him. This is a story I think they just never thought would come out. And maybe Trump honestly, sincerely doesn't believe it. Maybe he's like, no, this is bullshit. I don't really believe it. The intelligence is conflicting, you know?
Just believe in COVID being a real problem.
Here's my question.
I can see that Trump would convince himself of the truth of what he wants to believe, but what's his motivation for doing so?
Well, here's my question now, because this is one thing I'm not seeing anywhere. I keep seeing over and over, I keep seeing pundits and politicians saying, okay, well, he was briefed in March, he was briefed in February, he was briefed last year, whatever. Now we know he has been fully briefed. In fact, this morning, his national security advisor said that the president has been fully briefed on this whole thing. Now what? My question is, now what?
We can worry later about when he learned it. Also, there's no, like, what, like, that's not even the issue now, because Trump is not held accountable for, like, when he learns stuff. So, like, even forget that for now. We do know it now. It's still a thing. What's he going to do about it? Absolutely nothing, well, it seems like.
This morning he tweeted that it's a media hoax. Yeah. So I think we know he's not going to do anything about it. What will Congress do about it? There are calls to have, you know, hearings, investigations, inquiries on this. I don't know if Mitch McConnell said a word about it yet, but yeah, you know, Susan Collin is slightly concerned. Yeah, but Trump is like, this is a media hoax to hurt me and hurt the Republicans. That's what he tweeted this morning. So we know he's going to do absolutely nothing about it.
So will they do anything? I mean, normally they'd care about this. It's not something that they'd consider like a partisan issue on its face. Like, they would care about this, but
I mean, this is a big deal.
It is. They would. In a world without Trump, this wouldn't be that this kind of political issue. Like, it wouldn't be a question of like, oh, are Republicans for against? They're against this. But, like, Republicans are against this, hands down. Aside from the issue of Trump not being against it and they being locked up with Trump's whims.
Yeah. I mean, the real question is, I mean, I guess, you know, he's got his plausible deniability by saying that, okay, well, the intelligence was conflicting and so blah, 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 whatever. I didn't take it seriously or I wasn't even told that it was something that I need to respond to. Although I did see on Rachel Maddow's show a couple days ago, and I don't know what the source is, but she's pretty legit. I mean, she said that apparently in March or February when he was briefed about this, he was actually presented with three options on how to respond to Russia, which is a pretty common thing that's done. You know, the Pentagon and DOD will offer the president different options. So it was raised to that level. They did think it was important enough that some kind of response was merited, but he didn't choose any of them. So now he won't do anything. Let's say Congress decides to act on this and they decide to somehow sanction Russia. The real question is, will Trump follow through with it or not?
No, he won't. Like, so nothing's going to happen. We're going to have American soldiers die with no retaliation, and Russia is greenlit to keep doing this.
So, you know, we talked, I think, last week or the week before about how there's been uncomfortably, like, two or three times that Russian planes have been, like, seen flying over Alaska or in spaces they shouldn't be. But interestingly enough, Russia, the Russian Defense Ministry, just posted a video, I think, 2 days ago, showing how they intercepted two U.S. planes. One was a Navy plane and one is an Air Force plane. They're flying and you see Russian aircraft, military aircraft, then kind of pulling up next to them and videotaping them and kind of escorting them out of the area. They said the planes were flying too close to the Russian border. And so, yeah.
So, at the end of the day, Russia is not pro-Trump. In the sense that, like, they are not, they have no genuine interest in Trump himself. They have no genuine love for Trump. But they do love how Trump destroys
America.
He's
a tool.
Yeah.
He's a Putin tool.
So are they now deciding that, I mean, what they're doing does not seem geared at helping Trump win. It's possible they decide it's a lost cause and, like, not to focus their efforts on helping him win again, but to destroy America in other ways.
Oh, I think that's a big part of it. I think at the end of the day, they don't care if it's Trump.
They would have wanted him in there to keep tearing things down, but since that seems like it's not possible.
No, but again, like, this, we only know about this because of the leak. If this information has been out there for like a year plus and we're just learning about it now, it's not because Russia could be like, yeah, we're doing it. We're going to continue to do it. If they really want to hurt Trump, what they can say is, yes, we are. Yes, we are. What are you going to do about it? Trump, what will you do about it? And Trump will do nothing. That's how they're really going to hurt Trump.
I just don't think they're prioritizing helping him win.
I think what Putin wants is to completely destabilize the United States, and that's what he's done. He's done it by with the fake media stuff. He's done it, but like, every institution that Trump has managed to undermine is like part of Putin's agenda, I think. And I think this probably goes along with it. However, I will defer to military and analysts to tell us more about what they think. And that'd be an interesting question to explore next time. But I do want to report also that there's been another bounty that's been talked about. The bounty put on Trump. Did you hear about this? Not exactly a bounty, but okay. Iran. Iran has issued arrest warrants for Trump and apparently 30 other people, but they haven't, they only named Trump, okay? They have issued arrest, they've asked Interpol for help in detaining Trump. The prosecutor, state prosecutor, said that Trump, along with 30 others, were responsible for the January 3rd attack that killed General Qasem Soleimani, that they faced murder and terrorism charges. And Soleimani oversaw the Revolutionary Guard Quds Force, for folks who remember, it seems like such a long time ago, whole nother world before COVID. But that was just in January. So I don't know if Trump's responded to that, but Interpol's like, yeah, we don't get involved in that stuff. I always find this whole dynamic so interesting because like Russia and Iran are so closely aligned. And yet, all right, some other big news. We've had some SCOTUS decisions we might want to talk about.
Yes, I've not read any of them yet, but I've heard some of the cases that came out.
Yeah.
And Roberts continues to cement his control over the court.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it all comes down to him in, like, every single decision. well, let's start with June Medical. And this is one that went the right way. 5-4 ruling in which the Chief Justice ruled with the liberal justices, basically striking down a requirement that Louisiana had put into law saying that doctors that provide abortions must have hospital privileges within 30 miles of the practice. This is known as TRAP, or targeted regulation of abortion providers. There was a very similar Texas law, and also it was deemed unconstitutional. And so the June Medical ruling this week basically affirms that. So the June Medical ruling affirms that previous precedent. So basically what they're saying, it's unconstitutional to require that doctors have this, that abortion providers must be, have hospital privileges.
What it comes down it's to, not a Roberts decision in all of these cases, this entire term has just been the Roberts rule of, I will vote the conservative way on most cases if I can, but don't give me a case where you're acting such bad faith that I have to act in bad faith to adopt it. That's his line. He's not promoting like liberal Jewish jurisprudence or anything like that. He's in fact giving a roadmap a lot of the time for how they can,
how to get around it.
Yeah, but he, what he will not do is, when it's obvious bad faith, he is the lone conservative justice who's not willing to pretend that a spade is not a spade. So in this case, again, the law was clearly unconstitutional, had been ruled that way before. There was no plausible argument for how this was different or justifiable. So he wasn't going to go there. Like, he's not going to go there. Same with like the census question case, and same with the Title VII case. When he's being lied to, he will grudgingly and very narrowly rule the way that the law is pretty clearly directed towards. But in cases where there's no sort of like bad faith issue going on, there's no issue of like the Trump administration or state governments acting in undeniable bad faith, there's nothing liberal coming out of Roberts's rulings.
Right. And we saw that recently also this week with Espinoza, the Espinoza case. So in this ruling, again, another 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court decided that religious schools should have the same access to scholarships and funds as other private schools. So this was a victory for Betsy DeVos. But yeah, so this is kind of politically tough for this administration, because on one hand, they're, you know what I mean? Like, Roberts is not reliable for them, I guess, each time.
He is reliable if they just have functional government.
If they were competent.
If they were competent, Roberts would be reliable. It's just that they're not. And his personal line is that he won't look stupid by pretending to believe their bullshit.
Yeah. So Trump tweeted earlier this month, we need new justice of the Supreme Court. If the radical left Democrats assume power, your Second Amendment right to life, secure borders, and religious liberty, among many other things, are over and gone. Trump tweeted earlier this month. I mean, like, it's kind of like, for him, it's always a win-win. He always finds a way to spin it anyways.
It's a little demoralizing because for some conservatives, they have supported Trump solely for the judges. So they're like, well, was it really worth it? But at the end of the day, they're going to answer that question with, yes, it was worth it. It just didn't quite work out as well as they hoped.
It's still worth it.
Any support over this. He's not.
Right. I don't think so. But especially because, I mean, he also, besides the Supreme Court justice, has appointed, what, 100 plus federal judges on the federal bench. And that's going to have
200.
Yeah. 200. Oh, excellent. So that alone is certainly worth it.
Well, maybe it's disappointing to them, but it's not going to in any way be a negative for Trump's reelection prospects.
Right. They're just going to try this another way, and they realize that.
Anything, it could hurt Trump. Like, say the Supreme Court actually heard the ACA case and overturned the rest of it, so Obamacare is gone forever before mm-hmm. the election. That would hurt Trump. Like, he wants that to happen, but he needs that to not happen before the election because – guess what? He has no plan and backup. And in a pandemic, that would be tens of millions of people suddenly without insurance.
But he keeps doing things that I think objectively, I feel like this is going to hurt you. Like when you have rallies and you have all these events with thousands of people who are potentially your voters and you're like willing to put their lives at risk or the lives of their loved ones at risk when they go back to grandma or whatever. Like, isn't that going to hurt? Shouldn't that hurt you more than the liberals? I don't understand. They don't think this.
Not convinced that reality is a real thing either. He thinks that spin is what is real and that spin can overcome anything else. And he has not quite accepted the fact that the pandemic it's not spin proof. It can be spin very well, as we've seen, but it is spin resistant in a way that many other things in American political life are not. And he's committed to this idea that he can do everything as normal and spin it the right way. And that the consequences will not be of the sort that impact him.
I'm still mystified at why he's not even concerned for his own health. I mean, he's squarely in the demographic that's high risk.
Everyone around him is tested constantly. He's not perfectly safe. I'd be nervous too, but I think he feels like he is perfectly safe because everyone who ever gets near him gets a test.
Do you think maybe he got it already and like has antibodies or something?
No.
All right. Some other things in the news. Let's see. Trump continues to be committed to the Confederacy. he recently signed an executive order. Did you read about this or hear about this?
I saw that he has spent a lot of time tweeting about people who deface monuments and how he wants to send them to prison for 10 years.
Yes, in excess of a 10-year prison term.
Well, that's not possible because even like the most extreme version of it would be 10 years would be the maximum, but whatever.
He signed an executive order making it a federal offense, I guess, or felony or whatever, to deface these statues. There are apparently like two or three activists who are currently, and then he spent, I can't remember what day it was, like half the day tweeting like wanted pictures of people from protests. It was just one after another. They're pictures of people who are at protests. He's tweeting their pictures saying that the people are wanted for defacing statues so they can be arrested, prosecuted under this new, whatever this is.
He really is like just a classic authoritarian who at his core feels that any kind of protest is, even if it's not directed at him, any kind of public protest is a referendum on him and his ability to be president.
And but he loves MAGA protests. He loves the MAGA rallies.
But he thinks that any kind of protest that's like not explicitly in support of him is a sign of his weakness as president. And that if he was a true strong man, if he was a true Putin or a true President Xi, he would be able to stop that and quash it. And the fact that he can't is a sign of his own weakness, which in a way it is. It is a sign of weakness and that it's a sign that he's bound by some degree by the Constitution.
It's telling in so many ways that, like you brought up before, that Black Lives Matter has nothing to do with him in many ways, because this is about an issue that's been ongoing for, I mean, like hundreds of years, basically. And yet his response is MAGA, basically. And so he is directly, I mean, it all becomes about him, but also it means that, yeah, he absolutely, he stands for white supremacy. Also, just this morning he tweeted it yesterday, then he retweeted it this morning that I will veto, he's so goddamn racist. I will veto the defense authorization bill if Elizabeth Pocahontas Warren
of I guess if she continues to want to rename Fort Bragg, Fort Robert Lee, and other military bases from which we won two world wars, if that's in the bill. I guess that's something that's been introduced.
Let them veto it. See what happens.
If he vetoes it, what happens? They just lose funding? They don't have funding for this period?
Yeah, let's see how that goes for him.
Yeah. Yesterday, by the way, it's USCIS, which is the Department of Citizenship and Immigration Services, sent a notice to 13,000 CIS employees notifying them that they are going to be furloughed because they don't have money. The reason they don't have money is, like the Post, they are self-funded through immigration applications, which are really flippin' expensive, but they're not getting any. And so they're not getting any, so they're not funded. 13,000 people are going to be furloughed unless Congress authorizes some emergency funding. And I don't know if that's going to happen. So, yeah, I feel like everything's kind of falling apart.
And the important thing is we find those protesters.
Right. That's where Trump spoke. Protect the statues. Protect the statues. Okay. Anything else? We always like to do a little quick check on Trump before we sign off to see if he's tweeted anything else we need to mention right before
we leave. Like off Twitter, and actually, not going to lie, it's been kind of nice.
Has it been?
It has been, yeah. Because you can pretend it's not happening. You can pretend the world doesn't exist for a little bit.
But there's so much to catch up on, right?
There is. And let's see. I'm doing it now. Let's do it. Let's see what he has tweeted in the past.
Go ahead, Susan.
We've got dun dun dun. Oh, he's tweeting about defunding the police.
Yep. He's not supposed to say that. New York City is.
Yeah. Pigs in a blanket, fry him like bacon. I've not heard that one. I don't know what it comes from, but it's really funny. The president is tweeting out, pigs in a blanket, fry him like bacon.
Yeah, yeah. And actually somebody else tweeted this out because it's grammatically correct. It's got like commas in the right place and stuff. Somebody else is tweeting this out for him, maybe Mark Meadows or something. And then he also tweeted that Biden was asked questions at a press conference and he read answers from a teleprompter. That means he was given the questions. Like Crooked Hillary, what? Okay. Then the fake bounty story and
I'm scrolling down it right now and it's just Groundhog Day. It's just more of the same. Like it's always different, but it's always the same.
Always different, all the same. All right. Okay. That's it for us this week. And I guess we will not be back next week. We'll be back the week after.
And right, we'll see your signs and I'll be there whenever. Get in there that moment.
I commit to that as well. All right. Thanks so much, Susan. And thank you guys for listening in. And we'll be back in 14 days.
See you then.
But not so fast. Hang on there because we have a little bit of a bonus for you this week. And I'm really excited to be able to bring this short interview to you because of the real sensitive timing of the issue we are about to discuss. And that is the impending Israeli annexation of parts of the West Bank. It's one of those any day now type of situations. We want to report on it further, but we wanted to talk to somebody who's an expert on the issue. And so I'm really pleased to be able share this conversation I had with Michael Sfard. Michael is an attorney specializing in international human rights law who represents numerous Israeli human rights and peace groups, as well as Palestinian communities and Israeli and Palestinian activists. He regularly argues cases before Israel's High Court of Justice. He was a reservist in the IDF, and he became a conscientious objector and spent 3 weeks in military prison due to his refusal to serve as a military escort for settlers in Hebron. Michael won the Emil Greenswig Human Rights Award in 2012, which is awarded by the Association for Civil Rights in Israel to an individual or NGO that has made a unique contribution to the advancement of human rights in Israel. Michael also writes frequently for the Israeli daily Haaretz. First of all, Michael, thank you so much for joining us on such short notice all the way from Tel Aviv. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
I first saw you on a video that was being shared by the New Israel Fund, and I wanted to ask you, and I've told our listeners, you know, about your background and expertise and your many years of working on these issues. So could you please explain a little bit about the issue of annexation in general? Not all of our American listeners are really familiar with what that means on the ground. What parts of the West Bank are currently under Palestinian rule? What parts are under Israeli rule? And how annexation would change that?
So the West Bank has been occupied by Israel in 1967, and since then, for 53 years, it has been under belligerent occupation, which is a term used under international law to describe a situation in which an army that is foreign to the inhabitants of a certain territory effectively controls that territory. And international law regulates that kind of a reality, and it imposes certain obligations and restrictions on the powers of the occupying power an occupying force in the occupied territory, and it provides basic rights to the occupied people. Now, one of the main issues about occupation is that it is not sovereignty. The occupier is a temporary manager of the occupied territory, and international law after Second World War has made it very clear that sovereignty cannot be acquired by force, cannot be acquired unilaterally, but only through negotiations and an agreement between the competing parties. What Israel has been doing in the last several years is pursuing a policy that contravenes directly probably one of the most fundamental principles of the international legal order of the post-Second World War. And the listeners should know that when the United Nations have been established in 1945 and the United Nations Charter was signed, it was the first time in human history that the prohibition on use of force in international relations was anchored in law. Never before was that idea of the prohibition of use of force a legal norm. And the idea that a certain international party, a state, cannot annex unilaterally a territory cements the prohibition on use of force, because a world that allows exploitation of occupied territories and annexation of occupied territories is a world that incentivizes wars of aggression. So the annexation bid that is pursued by the government of Israel, in fact, has much more implications than on the Israeli-Palestinian or even the Israeli-Arab conflict. It has ramifications to every international dispute around the globe. And so that's in the international law plane. But if Israel will indeed annex certain territories of the West Bank, certain parts of the West Bank, there will be also implications, very grave and dramatic implications, on the Palestinians that live in the West Bank, because those restrictions on the powers of the governing occupying force, which I referred to before, will be lifted, and basically Israel would be free to expropriate massive amounts of land and to forcibly transfer Palestinians who live in the annexed territories.
My understanding is, so this is not the entire West Bank, it's parts of the West Bank, and this is primarily in an area known as Area C, that's right?
Yes.
And is in that area, I understand that it's a lot of Palestinian agricultural land exists in that area. So is the annexation going to be primarily of those lands or also of the residential areas that Palestinians live in?
Yes. Israel is eyeing, the Israeli government is eyeing on the open spaces, on the farmlands, on the places where development of Israeli towns and cities and the villages can take place. So basically, the attempt is to condense the Palestinian population into the build-up area of their cities and villages, and take as much as the open land as possible through annexation. That is, we don't know what would be the parameters of the annexation. The Trump plan suggests in the maximum 30% of the West Bank. That's 50% of Area C, the open space that is not built up, that is not urban of the West Bank. But lately we heard that maybe the Israeli government would divide the annexation into several stages. And so we might find ourselves with a first stage that is smaller.
Which actually leads me to my question. So, which is why now? Is it because this was specifically proposed as part of Kushner and Trump's plan? Or has this been something that's been discussed politically in Israel before that?
Annexation was a non-starter for 50 years. Mm. That was, I think, even the most fundamentalists of the settler movement did not believe that in our generation, annexation would become a realistic option. And then in the last 3.5, 4 years, the world changed. And there have been a several developments that each and every one of them was for them a miracle. The most important one is, of course, Trump being the president and pursuing a policy that even the right, the most right-wing government in Israel has never openly pursued, of annexation, of making sure that Palestinians would never have a complete, a total control over their own fate, perpetuating the Israeli control over them, and leaving them with some kind of self-rule that is even weaker than local government. Then you have Europe that became very weak in recent years because of its own internal affairs, the refugee crisis, the Brexit, the rise of the illiberal governments in Eastern Europe. All these things, together with a very shift to the right in the Israeli parliament, has made it possible suddenly to pursue annexation. All the stars as if aligned, and the window of opportunity is very short because no one knows what will happen after November in D.C. But it is clear that if Trump is no longer the president, that window will shut down. So we have, we all knew that this is going to be a very hot summer because that's just like annexation was not an option for 53 years prior. If it doesn't happen now, it might not be possible in the next few decades.
Can you talk a little bit about also clearly there will be impact on Palestinians, but there will also be some impact on the Arab neighbors of Israel, specifically Jordan. But can you talk a little bit also about how Israel's relationship in the last maybe 5 or 6 years has changed, maybe with even its Gulf Arab neighbors that might have also made this possible?
Yeah, I mean, the Israeli government has made a lot of efforts to create some kind of semi-official relationships with the Gulf states. The Trump administration was very helpful in that. And the Sunni governments of Jordan and Egypt and have all been part of this making Israel normalization with Israel. However, both Egypt and Jordan have peace accords with Israel, who quote in their first preamble, the Security Council Resolution 242, which includes the prohibition on acquiring sovereignty by force. And so Israel, by pursuing annexation, would not only violate the or breach the Oslo Accords with the Palestinians, but also with its neighboring countries, because the whole premise of the peace process between Israel and the Arab world, including Egypt, Jordan, and the Gulf states, was that Israel would not engage in unilateral steps that change permanently the status of lands that it conquered in the war in 1967. So apart from destabilizing Jordan because one has to understand that Jordan has a very big community of Palestinians living in refugee camps and all around Jordan. And so any step that is taken by Israel in the West Bank, especially the annexation, would immediately create the destabilization in Jordan, because the government in Jordan would be under huge pressure to severe ties with Israel. And so it will be cornered into a situation where, on the one hand, the popular demand is to take measures against Israel and not to continue the normal relationships with it. And on the other hand, you have the King of Jordan, you know, wanting to have a normal relationship with the West, with the American administration, with Europe, right, and with Israel. So that, even in that, on that front, annexation is a really very dangerous step to the region.
Can you tell us a little bit about where is Israeli public opinion in all of this?
You know, this is the most fascinating thing. One of the, in a moment, I'll say something about the polls of that discuss the issue of how many Israelis are against the annexation, how many support it. But first, I want to say that all the polls that have been conducted show one staggering thing. When Israelis are asked to name the most important topics, the most important subjects, challenges that the Israeli government has, annexation is one of the last ones. Only 4% of Israelis think that that the question of stretching Israeli sovereignty over parts of the West Bank is one of the most important things. Most Israelis are much more concerned with the coronavirus, with the economic collapse, and with other challenges that we have as a nation. Now, the question of support of annexation was always an option that was not supported by the majority. The majority of Israelis did not want annexation for years, because for them that would mean one state, one binational state, or one apartheid state in which Israeli Jews have all the rights and can vote, be elected, and run for government, and Palestinians cannot. And Israelis are not fond of any of those options. What happened recently was that because, and only because, our big brother, the bully, the American administration, pushed us into this annexation idea with the Trump plan, suddenly some Israelis that in the past were against it said, well, why not? And then suddenly the gap between those who oppose annexation and those who support it became smaller. There is still a majority of Israelis, according to the polls that are published in the Israeli media, there is a majority of Israelis who do not support annexation. And the more we know about the possible potential costs of annexation, that gap again rises. But again, what is most important is that most Israelis don't really care. They would not go out to the streets to oppose annexation, but they would also not go out to the streets to make it happen.
Well, I guess that leads me to maybe my final question, and is this: what are the forces then that might have any leverage in stopping this annexation, or do you think this ship has sailed?
No, I don't think this ship has sailed. I think we are the closest we've ever been to potential annexation. But I don't think it's a done deal. I think there is one huge power that is the driving force behind making annexation an option, and that is the American administration, together with the Israeli prime minister's own personal issues, the legal problems that he has, the corruption charges that he is facing, and so the whole matrix of his considerations has completely changed in the last 2 years. But then on the other hand, you have the international community, all the international community aside from America, which opposes it. And every day there is the pressure on the government of Israel not to go ahead with annexation mounts. And European countries that for the first time in that I can remember even used the word sanctions, warned that Israeli-European commercial relations will change, that some of their own legal obligation would preclude them from continuing some of the joint projects with Israel. These things have, you know, each and every one of them by itself is not enough, but it mounts, and there's more and more pressure. And then you have the Jewish communities in America and in Europe. We hear more and more of their opposition, even the most pro-Israel, most communities, ones that have always been supportive of Israel, even in the most difficult times, are now very clear. Their voices being heard here. So you have a basket of actors that are making the point that this is a completely no-go. And I think that, you know, I just hope we have enough time for that pressure to do its work, because of the corona pandemic, the idea of annexation that stormed into our life basically in the beginning of this year was not discussed by the Israeli public because the pandemic consumed all the public discussion. And suddenly, in the last few weeks, when the date of the proposed annexation grew closer, suddenly the public discussion was ignited. And I hope we have enough time to make the most of it, because at the moment, more and more voices join in one big demand to stop it.
I certainly hope so, too. Thank you so much again for all your work. Can you just tell our listeners how they can find you online, if they can follow your work or any more of your commentary?
Yes, I have a Twitter handle, which is SfardM, and then S-F-A-R-D-M. And on Facebook, you can find me again under Michael Sfard.
And they can also read you on Haaretz regularly, right?
You can also read me in Haaretz and through the different human rights organizations that I serve as their legal counsel, as Yesh Din and Breaking the Silence, Peace Now, and others.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you. I appreciate your work.
Thank you, Rabia. Thank you
Thanks,
very
Michael.
Much.
Bye-bye. Be safe.
Bye. Thank you.
A big thanks to all our listeners for tuning in to the 45th podcast week after week. And if you'd like to give us further support, you can do that by becoming a patron at patreon.com/45thpod. By doing so, you can become a supporter and patron for as little as $5 a month. And to do so, again, go to patreon.com/45thpod. A shout out and thank you to our sponsors. They make this program possible. And I urge our listeners to please check out our sponsors and use their products. And thank you to them for helping us produce week after week. Thank you to our audio producer, Hannah McCarthy, our executive producer, Mithal Thelhan, and you can find us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Our handle is at 45th Pod. Our website is www.45thpod.com. Thanks again for tuning in. See you next week.